In his memoirs, Madero recalls his first attempts at communicating with spirits through what he called semi-mechanical writing. The year was 1891. He was in Paris studying at the prestigious School for Advanced Commercial Studies when, as he tells it, quite by chance, I happened across some issues of the Spirit Review to which my father subscribed. Intrigued, Madero sought out more works by the immortal Alain Kardec and other Parisian spiritists. I didn't just read those books, he confesses, I devoured them. Their teachings were so rational, so beautiful, so new, they seduced me. And since that time, I have considered myself a spiritist. He attended seances and was told that he was a semi-mechanical medium, able to channel spirits by surrendering control of his writing hand to a spirit visitor, while remaining aware of the words as they were being formed. He managed no more than a few scribbles, which he attributed to tired hands. After a few tries, he gave up. Ten years later, Madero, now a successful entrepreneur working to diversify and expand the family business, was back in his hometown, San Pedro de las Colonias. At loose ends while he nursed an ailing uncle back to health, he decided to try his hand at automatic writing again, with very different results. After just a few attempts, I began to feel a force foreign to my will move my hand with great rapidity. A few days later, I write with big, tremulous letters, "Love God above all things and your neighbor as yourself." That first message, and those that followed, he relates, gave me to understand that communications from beyond the tomb came to speak to us of transcendental matters, always expressed with great competence and with a beauty of language that surprised me and surprised those who knew my scant literary gifts. In his memoirs, written several years later, he testifies that these messages from the spirit world took a young libertine, useless to society, and made of me a respected family man, concerned for the good of the country and committed to serving it to the fullest extent of his powers. I have no doubt, he continues, that the moral transformation I underwent, I owe to my mediumship. What's not said in these passages, recorded in 1909 with an apologetic ear to posterity, is that the source of nearly all these transcendental messages was the spirit of a dead younger brother, Raul, his spirit guide and guardian angel, and that Raul's tone was more often hectoring and exasperated than consoling or solicitous. The first preserved communication with Raul is dated January 10th, 1900. It's directed at Madero and his ailing uncle, Manuel Madero, his father's younger half-brother born just a few weeks after his nephew Francisco. "Here I am," writes Raul, "and I come gladly to give counsel, to tell you again to do good in all things, speak ill of no one, seek always to elevate your spirit, and consult often with God and your spirit protectors so that they might help you control yourselves and watch your tongues. Because as the great prophet Christ said, that which most harms a man is not what enters his mouth, but what comes out of it." Raul moves quickly from the injunction not to speak ill of others, possibly directed at Manuel, to sexual matters. "I also insist that you be chaste and arm yourselves with a fortifying energy to reject all temptation. God's law does not tell you to misuse the money you have to tarnish an unfortunate who sells you her honor for a piece of bread." While Raul acknowledges that their recent conduct has been exemplary, he worries about future lapses and advises them both to get married and to respect their wives. "God's law says that each man should choose a companion, and the two of them are obliged to remain mutually faithful. Those of you who occupy elevated positions in the world, if you believe that poor people have no honor, shame my dignity." And then he chides them for stalling. If you're not already married, the two of you have no one else to blame because you've encountered excellent girls who love you with true affection and who would make you happy. But blinded by your egotism and self-love, you have believed that you could find better. It's for the best that you repent of the bad you have done, and if possible, repair it in this life, because if you don't, you'll have to do it in another and under worse conditions. In his second recorded message, Raul addresses his brother Francisco directly on the topic of marriage. Everything I've told you is true. You well know the wrong you did to Sarita, Madero's future wife, Sara Perez, and it's better that you expiate the wrong you have done before you die. So that you might suffer more deceptions and be more severely punished, God has allowed an inferior spirit to come to mock you so that you would decide to continue talking to Margarita, who doesn't love you and will never love you no matter what you do. Now you've suffered enough and you're better for having understood the cause of your suffering. Wait patiently, as it seems you're doing, and soon you will find a companion worthy of you and who will make you happy. Raul is nothing if not tenacious. Madero swallows his pride and begs Sarita's forgiveness. She takes him back. They're married in a civil ceremony on January 26, 1903, and in church the following day. It is, by all accounts, a happy marriage.
Welcome to Revolutionary Spirits, a podcast about revolutions of all kinds and the spirits that shape them. I'm your host, Sam Buffington. This season, we'll be talking about the Mexican Revolution and the life of an improbable revolutionary named Francisco Ignacio Madero. Together with my father, Rob.
Hello, everyone.
A professor emeritus of women and gender studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, we'll explore Madero's remarkable journey from privileged son of one of Mexico's wealthiest families to revolutionary leader, to besieged president, to beloved martyr, and the spirits that accompanied him along the way. So what I'm hearing is that Francisco Madero, the famed leader of the Mexican Revolution, was a medium who was channeling the spirit of his dead baby brother.
That's right. I mean, it's an interesting and sad story. Madero's off at school in Baltimore, Maryland, St. Mary's College, which is a high school. He's off studying with his brother Gustavo, and he gets the news of his baby brother, who's like four at the time, who is in a horrible accident. He's carrying a long stick, and he knocks over a kerosene lamp. He's drenched in kerosene and it suffers severe burns. Lives for about 17 hours in incredible pain, and then dies. And so he gets this message, and he gets it from his mother, who was really distraught, obviously. at this thing that happens. And so Raul has a reputation, or at least as Madero remembers it in his memoirs, as being just a super sympathetic, cheerful, kind kid. So this is like his idealized baby brother who has this horrific accident. And then when Madero becomes takes up automatic writing and becomes a semi-mechanical medium, as he called it, when he takes that up, the first spirit who comes to communicate with him is his baby brother, Raul. And Raul is the one we read it in the introduction. Is the one who's talking to him and giving him advice about things.
Wow. I think what's interesting is, as I looked at all of this, is that Madero was not just taking messages for himself, but he seemed to be like also getting messages for other people. Were that just the people who came to these seances? How did that all work?
Okay, so Madero, when he starts out, and this is classic spiritist, you know, practice or good spiritist practice, is to do these things in seance. So you form a group of people, you try to get everybody kind of on the same page or in the same vibe, and so you're holding hands, you're around a circular table, and one person has a pencil in their hand, in this case Madero, and he, as the writing medium, will then sort of go into a semi-trance, not a complete trance, because that's not the kind of medium he is. And then his hand starts to write. But the messages that Raul is giving, because he's the first of the spirits that contacts Madero, are for the spirits' circle, not just for Madero, but for his for his fellow spiritists who are sitting around the table. And he's telling them things like how they need to behave and how they need to become better people. You know, you need to practice charity. You need to be good people. You need to, and then he's scolding them. You need to attend regularly. You can't just, you can't show up late. You know, if we're gonna do this stuff, you guys have to do it right. You have to study spiritism. He says, it's not that big a deal. Devote half an hour a day. But do the work, you know, read the books, come to the regular meetings. They had meetings sometimes two times a week, sometimes one time a week. Come to the meetings. We need to do this together. And so part of Raul's message is to that group. So he's talking to right. his brother, but it's not always, as it was in the introduction, directed just at Francisco. It's also about everybody else. And the other thing is that Madero as a writing medium is not just channeling Raul. He's also channeling other spirits. So especially in this early phase, he'll channel the spirits of, you know, someone's mother who's in the group. And Raul will say, because he's the spirit guide, Raul is the guardian angel spirit guide. So he says to Madero, I'm turning this over to another spirit. And so that spirit will then speak to her son. It'll be a somebody that they all know from the community who's died. But he's also channeling these other spirits, and they're sending along messages.
How is spiritism seen in Mexico at this time? I mean, we kind of assume that it's a Catholic country, a predominantly Catholic country. This time, so you know, who's attending these seances, and how is that like play in other parts of Mexico?
Well, Spiritism is interesting because Catholicism, the Catholic Church as an institution, is not especially tolerant of Spiritism. It has a lot of issues with Spiritism, but Spiritism doesn't necessarily. It has issues with the Catholic Church, but not with a lot of Catholic teachings. So you could be. I mean, not in the eyes of the Catholic Church would discourage this, but you could, in your own mind, easily be both a Spiritist and a Catholic.
Okay.
They're not mutually exclusive. Spiritism, as we saw in the intro, one of the references that Raul makes is to the great prophet Christ, and the use of the word prophet is interesting here because he's not calling him the Son of God. He's right. calling him a prophet. But that Christ's message was something, the very first thing that Madero writes, love God above all things and your neighbor as yourself, is straight out of the Bible. Mm-hmm. So this is very much compatible with Catholicism at the same time as the Catholic Church as an institution has issues with Spiritism. And Spiritism has issues with some of what it considers to be the corruptions and superstitions of the Catholic Church.
Who are the people at these seances? Do we know?
We know who a lot of them were. One of them was one of Madero's older uncles. There's a couple instances where his father's attending a session. And so sometimes Raul is talking to those people too. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that when Raul is communicating, for example, with his father, with Francisco in the room, we don't exactly know what's going through people's heads. But Raul is also trying to get to these members of the community because they're all members of the community and most of the time friends of the Maderos, right? So he's trying to get to those people and sort of bring them into the circle
right.
and kind of create this network of spiritists in Coahuila.
And that's, you know, are these messages from Raul, are they really like trying to set people up as like, you know, or give them advice about similar to what he's giving Madero about becoming better people?
Yes.
And that kind of those moral and ethical principles?
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes in the Madero circle, it's mostly men, but there are women who attend the seances. But when Raul is giving advice about how to be a moral person, how to be a good person, he's pretty clearly talking to the men in the group because he's telling them to don't do things like you need to quit smoking. Smoking is really bad for you. And this is advice not just to Madero, but to everyone. You need to quit playing billiards. You need to quit, you need to quit obviously visiting brothels, mm-hmm. things like that. You need to quit doing all of these kinds of things. And so that's part of what that message is. And it's directed mostly at the men in the group. Spiritism, as Madero sees it, is a moralizing, scientific religion that mm-hmm. moralizes, that provides sort of moral principles to live by. And that's what Raul is conveying to this group mm-hmm. and to his older brother, mm-hmm. Francisco.
So in some ways that sounds really similar to Catholicism. You know, what were those kind of virtues and vices the same kinds of things? Like, are they looking at the same kind of moral world?
Yes, exactly. I mean, Spiritism, as I said, as a scientific religion, doesn't really endorses a lot of Catholic values. It doesn't endorse the Catholic Church as an institution, but a lot of Catholic values are really very much present. And what Spiritists would argue is that there was a lot of truth in Catholicism. It was just, it's just some of that truth has been corrupted along the way as the institution has developed historically. Some were truths that people weren't ready for yet, but it doesn't deny that there's a sort of a core of truth. And Jesus is a really important figure for Francisco Madero and for his spirit guides like Raul and Jose. They're always referencing the teachings of Christ. And so there's that sense that at the core of Catholicism, there are these sort of eternal values. Like, for example, in the Catholic Catechism, you've got the sort of the pairing of what are virtues and vices, right? Humility on one side and pride on the other. So generosity as a virtue, greed as a vice, chastity mm-hmm. as a virtue, lust as a vice, patience on the one hand, wrath on the other, temperance on one hand, gluttony on the other, charity on one hand, envy on the other, diligence on one hand, sloth on the other. And so Madero, who went to spend a year in Jesuit school in a Jesuit high school in Saltillo, right? Madero had also been exposed to these values. These are long-standing values. He would have learned them in the catechism. He would have learned those particular values. And in Raul's message, it's all about that stuff. Charity is the most important thing. You need to be humble. You need to be generous. You need to be chaste. We already saw that in the intro. You know, you need to be chaste. You need to be patient with people and not wrathful, not like losing your temper all the time. You need to be temperate. You need to be, Madero's going to use in a lot of his writings, you need to be tranquil and serene in your spirit. And so these are very Catholic values. But in the eyes of Spiritists, they represent the true teachings that are at the core of Catholicism without them necessarily embracing the Catholic Church.
Yeah, that kind of calls me back to the last episode where we talked a little bit about, you know, having a like binary opposition to help define who you are. And like this just seems to bring that up for me.
This is absolutely that, and who knows, there may be the Catholic Catechism in, you know, that all of us sort of carry in our cultural baggage somehow. But yeah, Raul is very much about telling, especially the men in the group, this is what a good man is. A good man is somebody who's on one side of this binary opposition, and a bad man is somebody on the other. So somebody who's humble, generous, chaste, and so on is knows that they are those things because they are not prideful, they're not greedy, they're not lustful. And so it does sort of create that sense of a binary opposition, or what we call in feminist theory, right, a constitutive outside. What you would see is you define yourself in relation to what's outside of you. And it's interesting that we use that as, you know, jargon, right, theoretical mm-hmm. jargon, but it's really very clear in something like the Catholic Catechism. That's really set up as a binary opposition that you use to define yourself as good. You know you are good because you embody these characteristics and you can define yourself in relation to those characteristics. That, because, you know, you can set up these great things like this is what a good person does. But, you know, humanity, as the Catholic Church likes to point out, is also fallen at some level. You know, St. Augustine said, you know, humanity has fallen and is redeemed by Christ, right? So we're all going to make mistakes. So it's always a little bit, as you said in the previous episode, there's a lot of clarity in defining yourself against something bad, even when when your own behavior might be a little bit more complicated than that.
So I have to admit, I found it a little odd that Madero was getting his lessons in manhood from, you know, a dead child, a 4-year-old.
Well, this is kind of where Spiritism meets Catholicism, right? Mm-hmm. So in Mexican Catholicism, and Madero talks about his mother, like if I had continued to be instructed in Catholicism and sort of the innocent practices of my mother, I might have stayed a Catholic, but the Jesuits got in my head and then I had to reject it. But in the Mexican popular tradition that would have been part of his mother's reality too, his mother's kind of Catholicism, kids who die when they're sort of before coming of age are considered to be angelitos, little angels, and they're considered to be innocent. And it has to do probably somehow with they're not sexual beings yet and all of that. So they haven't been tainted by sin. Mm-hmm. And it's also a tradition in Mexican Catholicism and a lot of Latin American Catholicism for angelitos to be thought of as the guardian angel of the family. So having Raul be his guardian angel is a perfectly, you know, logical thing. Now, one of the things that's different about it is that Raul is an advanced spirit. So Spiritism allows for Raul, who dies as a child, to reappear in the writings because when he dies, he goes back to his spirit self, and he's an advanced spirit. So he's able to give adult kind of advice. He's a grown-up in the afterlife, even though he wasn't when he died.
In the introduction piece, we talked a little bit about it, but you know that there are also malevolent spirits, right? There are spirits who are giving you bad advice or who are leading you down the wrong path. What function did attaching morality to spiritual influences play for Spiritists?
Well, this was important to Spiritism, and it's not just Madero, but it goes back to Allan Kardec, who's the sort of the godfather of Spiritism. He's the one who wrote the first books on Spiritism, and this was a concern that you need to be in contact with the right kind of spirits. So mm-hmm. if when people die, they go into the spirit world, and you as a medium are in contact with those spirits, who you're in contact with can really determine the kind of messages you're getting. So when Raul, in the instance you pointed out, when Raul gets a message, when Raul tells Madero, God allowed, you know, sort of less advanced spirits to talk to you, to fool you into, help you get over Margarita, that's a lesser spirit. But it's really important in Spiritism that you exercise something called discernment. That you be able to tell who's a good spirit and who's a bad spirit. And it's pretty straightforward. If they're giving you good advice and it's good messages and it reflects good moral values, to get to your question, mm-hmm. if it reflects the right kind of moral values, then you're talking to an advanced spirit. If it's somebody who's messing around with you, if somebody who's like, you know, helping you get back at your neighbor, then you're in contact with a less advanced spirit. And they might be messing with your head, because and Spiritism really did believe that advanced spirits often, out of the goodness of their souls, would come back and be reincarnated. And they used examples of like Krishna and Hermes and things like that, but also Moses and Christ would become incarnated in order to pass on advanced spiritual messages to people and to help sort of make the world a more moral and ethical place. So there's that Spiritist evolution of things. And then Spiritism is interesting because it believes that there's been these sort of prophets all along, but in the present moment, meaning their present moment, that God has allowed, or a supreme being has allowed, or divine providence has allowed, for us to be in direct contact with spirits. But then mm-hmm. it's important to be able to discern good spirits from bad spirits. Now, it's interesting that Ignacio Loyola, who's the founder of the Jesuit order, and Madero went to Jesuit school, like way back in the day, that he was also concerned about discerning good spirits from bad spirits, not the spirits of dead people, but the spirits of demons and angels.
Right. Well, and kind of in that vein, I mean, we've talked about these kind of binary opposites in both Catholicism and in Spiritism. And so bringing this back to Madero, if Madero is kind of seen as the good man in this, or sees himself, or is at least working towards that, would he then see Porfirio Diaz as the opposite, as the bad man? Is he the opposite that he is trying to prove that he is not?
Right. Yes. He definitely was. There was definitely a sense that Porfirio Diaz was Francisco Madero's constitutive outside. I am who I am because I'm not that man. At the same time, Madero, and we'll talk about the book, the Presidential Succession book, next time. But Madero was also very careful to acknowledge Porfirio Diaz's good traits. He's a good family man. He's not personally corrupt. You know, he's just given himself over to sort of militaristic values, which he mm-hmm. represents as a former soldier and war hero. Mm-hmm. He's also given himself over to this materialistic, you know, capitalistic age where nobody cares about anybody else. And so Porfirio Diaz is not exactly a completely retrograde kind of spirit, but he's definitely somebody who is not necessarily a bad man, but is somebody who Madero is constructing himself against. I am not Porfirio Diaz. I'm not a military man. I hold spiritual values above sort of material values. And I have a moral and ethical sense. And I believe in democracy and he doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that ever play out to our knowledge, right? Within his family too? I mean, cause you know, we bring up materialism, and kind of capitalism and to a certain degree. And, you know, he's coming from this really rich family.
Yes.
Is that a thing?
It is definitely a thing. And it's never clear with Madero because he's very careful with people. He's pretty respectful, you know, until the end. He's pretty respectful of Porfirio Diaz, at least in his public writings. Mm-hmm. And he's always in his letters he's writing a lot to his grandfather and to his father. He's always very respectful, even deferential to them, acknowledging, you know, it's like honor your parents, you know, love your parents. It's that kind of thing. And he's really good about that. But at the same time, you can sense certain tensions in those relationships that they're clearly, you know, he feels like they're holding him back. And one of the Raul sessions, Raul is talking to Francisco Madero and his father. And they're both there together. And he says, you know, and he's talking to Francisco, you know, padre, the father, right? Okay. he says, you know, you really need to start thinking about spiritist values. You really need to start, you know, not worrying about the material world and reminding him. So there's clearly is that tension in the Madero family.
Right. You know, so Madero, I feel like it is really, you know, has this vision for a democratic Mexico, and that's really coming out of his spiritist practice, and this, you know, but also his like kind of new age way of thinking, or his more like maybe global way of thinking, and you know, but and also the fact that he's coming out of this like wealthy family. So, what does that new world look like to him, or this New Mexico?
Well, I think the coming out of a wealthy family, as he explains it, and as Raul was explaining to him in the introduction, you have this money, you've got responsibilities. Mm-hmm. You've been put on this earth to do something important, and you've been given the resources to do that. And right. So you need to get it together and to be more charitable. Now, the thing about democracy is interesting because what Madero is making a spiritist argument, as you're saying, and his argument is that free will is essential. This is, again, a Catholic thing, right? Free will is essential to human development. And if the Mexican people are deprived of free will by living in an undemocratic authoritarian state, they're not going to be able to develop spiritually, he means, not materially, but spiritually develop the way that they need to be. The Mexican people are being held back by their government, by their form of government, by this authoritarian regime is holding them back in spiritual terms, which is for Madero really important because that's all that really matters.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not just that they, you know, there's a certain, you know, sort of repressive things happening. It's that you're holding back people's spiritual evolution.
Yeah.
And this is in a global context, that would be you're holding back the Mexican people while other people living in democratic societies are advancing. And so it was essential to Madero. That was his mission, was to bring democracy to Mexico so that Mexico could continue its spiritual evolution and the Mexican people could enjoy it. And he, as a person of privilege, had the responsibility to help make that happen.
you know, faith was really seemed, you know, and his spiritism was so central to Madero in, you know, kind of thinking about his evolution as a man, as a leader. And, you know, that's not something that, you know, that's not a place where we get that, like that faith is not a central thing in our family. And, you know, we've already kind of mentioned briefly that the military wasn't either, right? And so, right. You know, in this, in a general sense, if you're not getting your like advice or your ideas of how to be a man from your faith, and you're not getting it from the military, where are you getting it from? And I'm curious to hear from you and talk a little bit about what it's like for me. But
That's a good question, because it's clearly there. You know, I mean, it's clearly, and maybe it is a lot similar. Maybe it is similar to what was going on with Madero. You know, it's like by the time he's introduced to Spiritism, by the time he finally discovers Spiritism, he says, I had no beliefs at that point. Mm-hmm. And he sees that as a good thing. He said, I had a completely open mind. I was just able to read Spiritism without any prejudices. I just read it and it was beautiful and new and, you know, all those kind of good things. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't feel, at least as he tells it in his memoirs, at the time he was 18. And so at that time he didn't feel like he was a Catholic anymore. He said, "Oh yeah, when I was at Jesuit College, I wanted to be, or Jesuit High School, I wanted to be a Jesuit. But by the time I was 18, that was all gone." Mm-hmm. And so I think that was probably how it was. You know, I was never taken to church as a child. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, my mother's an old Catholic family. My father's family was very religious. His mother was, you know, a devout Lutheran, but for my parents, no religion, but mm-hmm. certainly religious values. I mean, it's like what we talked about with the Catholic Catechism. You get that sense of like what it means to be good and what it means to be bad, but they're just kind of floating around in culture. So you're right, it's complicated because you don't have an institution clarifying it for you, and you don't have somebody you can go to. Like if you're in the Catholic Church, you go to your spiritual advisor, mm-hmm. you know? And I think one of the things that's interesting about Madero is Madero Spiritism is that it replaces the role of the confessor. Like, you know, you're the spirits, you're in communication with somebody who is giving you advice about how to be. Now in mm-hmm. my life, it wasn't that clear. You're just getting this, all these mixed messages, you know, and it's the sexual revolution, which is in one way a movement of liberation, but it's also a movement of, you know, from many people's perspective, sexual promiscuity and sort mm-hmm. of a loosening of sort of the bonds of society as represented by behaving yourself sexually, right? So it was a lot more complicated, but I think you do draw on your cultural baggage. Mm-hmm. But it's different when you're doing, you know, we're Americans. We like to choose about everything. You know, we make a fetish of choice. And so you get to choose which values you use to shape you, you know. That's naive. But I mean, in your own mind, you have a sense that you're right. that you're choosing the values that make sense to you, and you're rejecting the hypocrisy of institutional authorities, like whether it's the military, but especially the church. You're just, right. you know, yeah.
Again, this is something that as you started talking about this story to me, even before we were thinking about it as a podcast, it was one of those ones like, okay, well, where do I go? Right. And I think, you know, family is definitely a place, you know, right. I learned a lot from you, from both of my grandparents or grandpas, you know, other men in the family.
Right.
But I was also realizing that I think much more than any of these other generations, and maybe more than your generation, I don't know, but I, you know, got a lot of guidance on that from women, oh, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
From like my grandmothers, you know, particularly Alice, you know, I just right. remember right. like kind of the way that she talked about, you know, the young men in the world that bothered her.
Right.
You know, that had a real influence on me. You know, my sisters, my wife now, you know, like that, like I've learned, you know, that's a lot of them have really helped shape, you know, where I'm going to like help think about those things. And I think the other thing that's interesting in there for me is that, like, I think that's really good to a certain extent, right? I think that's like really important. And then I think that's something that these previous generations were really missing by just excluding women and like not listening to them about what it means to be a good man, right?
Right.
Or to be a good partner. Also, I mean, I think that there, I still find this thing missing in thinking about Victor, and that they're, you know, in particular, and now Charlie as well, right? And my kids, is just that, like, I think there are parts of that, right? Parts of like a masculine experience,
right,
that like Laura just doesn't understand.
Right.
And then that makes it kind of complicated to like think about like, okay, well, I do need to figure this out, like as the,
right,
like,
right,
as, right, as the male in the family in this place, and like be able, right, to like articulate, right, that, and then not having like a clear source is, right, like something that I'm still still looking for, right? And we're just flooded with this information these days, right? There's just like a million podcasts that you can go and listen to about like what you need to do as a man, or, you know, YouTube videos or,
right,
articles. Right. Like, I mean, there's no end to
men's,
to that,
studies, right?
Right, right.
Well, as one of my colleagues said, don't I have a PhD in that? A female colleague.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's where it gets tricky, because, you know, you're talking, you're right about finding out about what it means to be a man from women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not really apparent in the Madero story, but mm-hmm. it's clearly, it was definitely part of his life. He does mention it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he does mention, you know, my mother's Catholic faith is, you know, innocent Catholic faith is something I might have been able to embrace,
mm-hmm.
but I was exposed to this very masculinist Jesuit sort of vision of Catholicism, and it was superstitious and, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and just and corrupt and wrong in all kinds of ways. And so so I think we do like turn to women, and certainly in my own like experience, the 60s was also women's liberation,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was also, and sexual rights were starting to be talked about and things like that. So you are getting values from that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is often values about masculinity as seen from a woman's perspective,
mm-hmm.
which is very much, and many times those values were cast and are still cast in a set of binary oppositions.
Mm-hmm.
Like from a feminist perspective, this is a good man and this is a bad man.
Mm-hmm.
And good men do this kind of thing and bad men do that. Mm-hmm. And it's always clearer to not be a bad man. That's
mm-hmm.
always got more clarity than what do you actually do to be a good man.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, there are some issues, you know, around like how do you then transmit masculine values from, you know, a father to a son. And it's just a little bit more complicated in
right.
ways that aren't about just like making sure that you're a good man in the eyes of women.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I don't know. It's something that I still find myself searching for. And I think that like, you know, really endeared me to the Madero story. Right. Like,
right.
You know, like, okay, well, like I know I want something different.
Well, Madero is really looking for a kind of masculinity that's not toxic. What we would mm-hmm. use the word toxic masculinity
right.
a lot. And Raul is really helping him with that.
Mm-hmm.
Raul is telling him this is what a good man does. And, you know, it may be reflecting, you know, core Catholic values or whatever, but he's getting it from his younger, you know, from the spirit of the advanced spirit of his dead younger brother who died innocent of sin,
mm-hmm.
you know, like in some like metaphorical sense. And so he's getting it from a pure source, but
mm-hmm.
it's also a masculine source.
Yeah.
And this is interesting because spiritualism, which is kind of the American English variant of spiritism, is predates that and involves a lot of women. Spiritism
mm-hmm.
had a lot of women also, but it's also the founding father of spiritism is Allan Kardec, and he's, you know, and so in that sense, spiritism is more masculinist than spiritualism,
mm-hmm.
And Madero was pretty good, you know, for his time. You know,
mm-hmm.
I know that sounds wishy-washy, but
right.
he was pretty good for his time on women's rights.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's at one point, there's this sort of a Spanish radical Spanish feminist who comes over to Mexico to give speeches, and she's really like a scandal, you know.
Right.
And Madero's president, and everybody's pressuring him to censor her, and he's just like, no. I won't do it. You know, she has a right to speak her mind. You know, he said good things about women. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they were naive. And maybe that's inherent in what we were just talking about, right, too. The sense that purity resides in women.
Right.
You know, and maybe that's why we oppress them. Who knows? Right. But purity resides in women. And we need to find out about what a good man is, you know, by referencing women.
You know, I there's another element of it that where he is getting this from, like, a child or from a, like, from a perspective free of sin. And I think that, like, that is also interesting, kind of in a way of, like, thinking about this, like, into the future, right? And thinking about it into, like, the next generation, my kids, not that they will be free of sin in that way,
right,
but that, like, just always understanding that, like, my perspective is, like, tainted by patriarchy, right? By, like, these toxic masculinities that are, like, so prevalent at this point. And as we're, like, phasing those out,
right,
that, like, that there's going to be, this is, like, a whole different way of, like, seeing the world, or, like, what is normal. Yeah. And so trying to, like, be cognizant of that too, of, like, you know, where my sons are going is, like, whatever direction it ends up being is going to be, like, fundamentally different than like the world that I live in
right
now. And, like, and that not only that I live in, but that I came up in. Right.
Right. Right. Well, it's tricky because, like, think about the quotes from the introduction, you know, from Raul giving advice to Francisco, you know, to his older brother, Francisco, and some of the very first advice he gets is to be chaste, mm-hmm, and to quit, you know, quit abusing women.
Right.
So it's like, so much of the implication of that, this is the very first thing your, mm-hmm, spirit guide tells you is to get married.
Right.
And respect your wife.
Right.
You know, this is a call to be a different kind of man, mm-hmm, than would have been the masculinity of the time. So this is clearly Raul trying to shape Francisco. Or if Raul is Francisco's superego, you, mm-hmm, know, Francisco's superego trying to shape Francisco's ego into a different kind of masculinity, an alternative kind of masculinity, not just as a leader, but as a man too. Mm-hmm. And in this phase of Madero's mediumship, where he's mostly channeling Raul, that's what he's really working on, is becoming a good man, defined in spiritist terms, which is to mean moral, ethical, and committed to the advancement of you know, the spiritual well-being of, in this case, the Mexican people, but of the human race in general.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that makes him a little bit more, I mean, I guess to use generic terms, like, radical than some of his peers, even if they were ultimately more revolutionary, right?
Yes.
Like that, like his framing of self is maybe, like, more radical than even if his, like, vision for Mexico is not as radically different,
right,
or is not as, like, revolutionary as a Zapata or somebody like that, but that, like, his kind of personal thing is maybe more radical, at least as it relates to masculinity.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I think it is true that Francisco Madero is, in some ways, traditional as he is, and, you know, and as embedded as he is in patriarchal systems, he is a gender radical, you know, in some ways, in terms of masculinity, mm-hmm, in ways that someone like Emiliano Zapata, for example, or Pancho Villa is not, or any of the other Mexican leaders of the revolutionary leaders. Zapata is a real revolutionary. He really wants to change who holds the land. He wants to get land back for the people. He, you know, he's really going to transform economic and social structures in Mexico. Even Pancho Villa has a more radical vision of the kind of society he wants to live in socioeconomic terms.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of, like, if we're going to use Marxist sort of formulations of who's a revolutionary and who's not, Madero is a bourgeois revolutionary, mm-hmm, and they're, like, organic, you know, intellectuals and true revolutionaries. So that's so, but at the same time, you know, Zapata is drawing a lot of his charisma as a leader on traditional tropes of masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes this gets really interesting. Like in the Zapatista movement, there were a lot of women who rose into the ranks. Well, trans folks who were formerly women who become men to fight in the revolution and are recognized and raised, you know, and elevated in rank, you know, up to the rank of colonel and general mm-hmm. in the Zapatista ranks. But they are also performing traditional masculinity.
Right.
So they're, you know, in some ways that's a really radical move.
Right.
To just accept someone who the village might all know is really, I'm putting this in scare quotes, really a woman, mm-hmm. right? They might think so-and-so is really a woman, but if she can perform manhood in a convincing manner, she is accepted as a man into the revolutionary ranks. So that's pretty radical. Mm-hmm. It's a trans figure in, you know, a clear trans figure sort of occupying positions of revolutionary leadership. But he, right. meaning that leader, is performing traditional masculinity. And it's how convincing they are in their performance of traditional masculinity that makes them that leader.
I mean, this whole thing is just, I just see again, as we've talked about this, like so many parallels to today and some of the like movement things that, you know, just... You know, an organizer friend of mine and I were talking about like feeling kind of in between generations, right? Of the like, you know, Saul Alinsky generation of organizers
right.
and the Adrian Marie Brown, you know, version of organizing, and that we're kind of like somewhere in the middle of this. But I think that like also when we're looking at some of the movements that are happening in Minneapolis, for example, that are really using kind of not, I wouldn't say traditionally masculine ways of organizing, but like really traditional ways of organizing, right? Like that they're still like door knocking. They're like, yeah. going out and it's like, and then kind of like following the organizer playbook for how you make, you know, political change, how you get, you know, certain people elected to city council, how you get some sort of, you know, city ordinance passed, how you, you know, create a new department, in the city. And that those are like, those movements, like the folks who are involved in those movements, you know, are just like, I think in some ways, like more coming from a more traditional place than there's also this kind of like element that is more kind of about like self-actualization and, you know, healing past traumas and, you know, envisioning a different kind of future in a much more like, I don't know, they just kind of in certain aspects,
right?
Remind me more of like the kind of Madero model, right? I'm not saying that they're coming from rich families and have that kind of privilege or something like that, but like, but they're more of that, like, I'm thinking about this like for myself and for like the spiritual awakening of the people, right? In this way versus the like, some of the other folks who are like, I'm working on rent control.
Right.
And then there's this thing we're getting like this ordinance passed at the city and it's going to mean like X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And yeah, so I think that's just another like interesting parallel in this space.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, you do get people like Zapata who had a very clear agenda. You mm-hmm. know, we want the land back. We want it, you know, distributed equitably. You know, we want compensation for what happened to us and all of those kinds of things. But very clear agenda. Mm-hmm. And Madero is really about transforming the self as the first step. And that's what he's doing with Raul. They're working on transforming him so that he can become the kind of person who can lead a more general social transformation. Because that's really what he wants to do, is get Mexico into become a democratic society. And then, and we'll talk about this later, he wants to introduce Spiritist ideas into the public school system. But later, that can come later. But it is definitely about that self-care. And you mentioned privilege. And in this instance, it's important to recognize that that Madero has the privilege because he's got the social status to continue to represent a certain kind of leadership, at least up to a point. And we'll see some of the limits mm-hmm. of that. But he's got that kind of authority. It is because he comes from a place of privilege that he can be it's probably a huge stretch to call him a gender radical, but that he can be challenging mm-hmm. normative notions of masculinity at his time and normative notions, especially of masculine leadership.
Yeah. So why do you think it is that, you know, your parents came from somewhat religious backgrounds anyway, and in Buff's case, a fairly religious background, and that just didn't show up in in your household, like in, yeah, or in your, I guess in your dad's household. Yeah. And, you know, was it intentional for you not to bring that into ours?
Huh? This is speculation because mm-hmm. I really don't know what's going on in my parents' head. My suspicion is that both of them came out of places. You know, my mother's family was, you know, deep Catholic roots, at least mm-hmm. at least part of her family, right? And the family that she was living with, deep Catholic roots. And I think she just felt like it wasn't very modern to continue to, you know, to sort of to baptize your children. Mm-hmm. So she was not particularly religious. My grandmother, who converted to Catholicism, her mother, to marry my grandfather, took Catholicism really seriously. But the rest of the family were just like, you know, old time Catholics that were just like knew more about their faith than the priest did. So why consult him? You know, like mm-hmm. so they were more like that. You know, like my grandmother goes to my grandmother goes to her mother-in-law, my great-grandmother, and says, oh, you know, I feel terrible because I have to, so, you know, after when I do confession, every week I go to confession, I make my confession, and I have to confess to using birth control. And my great-grandmother's response, old-time Catholic family, my great-grandmother's response is, oh, honey, we don't tell them that. So you get some sense of, so I'm not sure if my mother gets her, like, lapsed Catholicism from from the Catholic side of the family,
right,
or from her, you know, and then why she didn't do that, but she didn't. Mm-hmm. And I suspect it was because, you know, modern people, we've just gotten past religion. Mm-hmm. You know, we've kind of gotten past that kind of religion. On my father's side, his mother was devoutly Lutheran, but his father wasn't necessarily. He kind of dabbled around in different kinds of religion, and it's not really clear. I mean, I wouldn't want to speak for him mm-hmm. at that point. Right. But I think for both of my parents, it was about being modern.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, this is, you know, the church, the traditional Lutheran church, because it was, my grandmother's Lutheran church was a very conservative Lutheran church. And, you know, the traditional Catholic church, this is the 1940s, you know, they're just like, we're the new hip young generation. They got married when they were really young, you know, 19 mm-hmm. and 20. So, you know, we're just beyond that. And so I think they felt like, we're not going to raise our kids with religion because we don't want to clutter their minds with, you know, those right. kind of traditional, you know, institutional values.
Right.
And I think they would have also felt, and they would probably wouldn't have articulated it this way, but I think they also felt that they were going to be able to convey the values mm-hmm. that matter. This is a little bit like Francisco Madero, you know?
Right.
These are the values that matter. We'll pass those on to our kids without all the bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah.
that comes with the institution. And yeah. so I think that's kind of where they were. And then I think we felt, or at least I felt, like I got those values. And right. so I was just going to pass on those values, and I didn't associate them, you know, with my grandmother's Lutheranness or my, you know, or the Catholic side of my, you know, my mother's Catholic, you know, roots.
Right.
I didn't associate those values as coming from them. I really accepted them as, this is what modern enlightened people do.
Right.
You know, and so it was, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true for, you know, like we also are not a religious household. And I think, but we spend a lot of time kind of thinking about our values and talking about our values with our kids and talking through issues. But I think we just found other ways. And if there's religion in our house, I think it's more about, you know, kind of a religion of social justice or you know,
no,
something
absolutely.
Like that.
Yeah.
That we're like, we're talking to people, you know, our kids about morality through that lens.
Oh, absolutely. That was true of our generation too, because it's the civil rights movement, it's the feminist, you know, feminist revolution, it's all of those kinds of things are happening, you know, in my formative years and are really, again, that's where I went for my values was, right. you know, Rampart magazine or, you know, my mother was an early subscriber to Ms. magazine. Mm-hmm. That's where I was getting my sense of what, you know, of what modern values would be.
Right.
But I think it's also a sense of being modern and, you know, probably modern and hip, you mm-hmm. know, and we don't do that old religious thing.
Thanks for tuning in to Revolutionary Spirits. In the next episode, we bid goodbye to the spirit of Raul and meet the new spirit guide known only as Jose. With Jose's support, Madero undergoes a transformation from reform-minded apostle of democracy to committed spiritual warrior, willing and able to lead an armed rebellion against the entrenched authoritarian regime of Porfirio Diaz.
Before we go, we have some very important folks to thank. Our amazing producer, Steven Renderos, the wonderfully supportive Center for Humanities and the Arts at the University of Colorado Boulder, several terrific historians, especially Manuel Guerra Luna, Enrique Krause, C.M. Mayo, Roberto Narvaez, Alejandro Rosas, Ignacio Solares, and Yolia Tortolero Cervantes. And last but never least, a special thanks to all of you for listening to Revolutionary Spirits.